You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
A warm welcome to our viewers this afternoon. I'm Makeda Henry-Nicky, a Governance Studies Fellow in the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative here at Brookings. I'm joined today by a distinguished group of speakers to discuss what we hope is the next pillar of the post-COVID recovery, and that is restoring economic dynamism in minority communities across the U.S. I want to just say that now, while today's discussion is focused on entrepreneurs and new workers, new economic development frameworks, we are by no means ignoring the plight of small businesses, which by any estimate are continuing to struggle. Yelp's economic impact report last fall estimated that 60% of shuttered businesses are now permanent closures. And the office of a recent Brookings paper estimated that bankruptcies are expected to top the 2019 filing rate by 140%. Within 2 weeks of the second round of the Paycheck Protection Program, 900,000 businesses received loans. All that collectively states that we're seeing a destructive picture of economic destruction. Congress, the Trump administration, and the Biden administration have all enacted defensive measures to stem these losses. But startups and the growth potential they have to offer are missing from the Build Back America framework. Countless studies have made it abundantly clear that new companies are net job creators. So without policies to restore entrepreneurial dynamism, particularly in minority communities, we are likely to see yet another jobless recovery, much like we saw in the Great Recession. Without new businesses, technology and innovation could be stifled and remain concentrated in affluent communities. So we hope that today's discussion will remind policymakers of the need to focus on the creation part of the recovery as much as they focus on advancing defensive policies and to offer thoughts on the way forward. I'm pleased to welcome my panelists, Hadia Mujahid. Hadia is the CEO and founder of HBCU VC, a nonprofit that is dedicated to changing how investment capital is formed and allocated to benefit historically underestimated groups. She's both a tech founder and software engineer and is obsessed with leveraging technology entrepreneurship for economic inclusion. Welcome, Hadia. Michael Brown is joining the panel today. I'm excited. Michael is currently the director of the Nevada Governor's Office of Economic Development. He previously served as director of business and industry, where he promoted a robust, diversified, and prosperous economy for all Nevadans. Welcome, Michael. Next, we're joined by Sean Arion. Sean currently serves as the executive director of LATech.org, a nonprofit coalition of tech companies to expand economic opportunity for LA's disconnected communities. Sean, thanks for joining us. And finally, we've got my colleague, Andre Perry. Andre is a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings and a scholar in residence at American University. His research focuses on race and structural inequality, education, and economic inclusion. So before we get started, I want to review a few of our housekeeping rules. I plan to moderate a 40 to 45 minute discussion with our panelists. Then I'll open the discussion to our virtual audience. We want to hear from you, so please send us your questions via email at events@brookings.edu, or you can tweet us your questions at brookings.gov. So without further ado, I'll turn to jump right in, and Andre, I'll start off with you. Now, you've written extensively on the issue of missing generations of Black businesses. According to the latest census data, of the 2 million Black-owned businesses in this country, just 124,000 are employee businesses. That's just 6.2%. Now, there's no arguing that the universe of Black-owned businesses is small, but they play an outsized role in producing quality jobs in their local economies, especially when they survive and grow into employer firms. So how do we solve this conversion problem, Andre? How do we convert 1.9 million people, sole proprietorship, into employer firms? How many of them do we need to convert? Is there some sort of industry composition dynamic in the background that's feeding this imbalance? I know you've got lots of views, so tell us, how should we be thinking about Black startups in this moment?
My microphone, turn it on. First of all, we need to recognize all the entrepreneurs who are essentially out of work during this Mardi Gras day. We need to uplift this day because in actuality, this is an important day for many Black businesses, bead makers, crews, and a lot of people are losing business. But I'm going to celebrate them anyway during this Mardi Gras day. So happy Mardi Gras. And then, as you stated, the more than 2 million and sole proprietorships, if we could find a way to convert them to employer businesses, meaning businesses with more than one employee, we would add significant revenue, jobs to the economy. But that would require us to move, if we would move 800,000 of those sole proprietorships, then we could reach into employer businesses. Then we would essentially be at 14% of the number of businesses would be employer businesses, which would match the percentage of us in the United States. Now, that's going to be hard for a number of reasons. One, so many sole proprietorships are in the gig economy. So we have a lot of Uber, Lyft drivers and other areas, but we also have a lot of barbershop owners, beauty salon owners, other types of businesses that we could scale up. The top three industries for non-employer businesses are personal and laundry services. They actually are with more than 500,000 businesses across the country. And then we have transit and ground passenger transportation coming in next, and then administrative and support services. And we know that those are not near the top revenue generating firms of the utilities. And by the way, the utilities, there are only 18, count them, 18 Black owned businesses in utilities. And then you have certain tech industries, manufacturing. These are the areas that we need to see growth. And so there should be an effort to increase the number of sole proprietors into employer businesses, but also to convert those employer businesses that are 10, 20 deep to double them. But there's only one way to do that, and that's to invest in Black businesses. The one area that we're certainly lacking is in capital. Most people actually start their businesses using the equity in their home or some other form of personal wealth. But because of the lack of wealth, we have fewer businesses, and we have less ability to scale up those businesses. And so there's no way around it. We first of all need to remove the drags of racism that preclude us from getting capital. And then we got to find a way to repair. And that means figuring out ways to invest in Black and Brown business owners.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, Hadia, I would not want to bring you in here. You not only have a fascinating professional background, right? Software engineer, tech founder, but you lead an incredibly innovative organization that's tackling some of these challenges that Andre alluded to. Sourcing capital, identifying promising businesses that can grow, scale, and convert into employer firms. So most of our viewers clearly haven't heard about HBCU VC. So tell us a little bit more about, you know, its mission. What particular gaps does your organization's work fill, and why the need to anchor around HBCUs?
Absolutely, thank you for having me. So ultimately, our mission is to remove some of the systemic barriers that prevent access to capital for Black, Indigenous, and Latinx entrepreneurs. The way that we do this is we look at the current demographics of the venture capital industry, the industry which is investing the money and deploying the money into entrepreneurs. And we recognize that there are some biases in the industry, especially when they have to make decisions at such an early stage with entrepreneurs that they may not know. So their personal biases may come into place. So the way that we are addressing this is increasing the representation of the decision makers, the check writers, in the industry so that they are reflective of the communities that need the utmost support. One of the reasons why we've anchored our programming around historically Black colleges and universities is that they are, centered in the locations where African Americans live, where 55% of African Americans in the United States reside in the southern part of the United States. And not only that, but HBCUs have been a key throughout the history of the United States in serving as basically a social mobility vehicle for African Americans. So this is why in our programming, it's key that we anchor around HBCUs and are inclusive to the people, the students, the talent that come out of HBCUs.
Yeah, I want to push you a little bit more there to tell us about the sort of industry mix. So Andre, in his overlay, talked about this over-indexing, if you will, of Black-owned businesses in laundry and personal services. And we know the potential for them to convert to employer firms is pretty low. And so what we really want to see is more of our sole proprietorships or Black-owned startups emerge in the tech and manufacturing sectors. How do you identify, those kinds of high growth, high potential startups in your work? Tell us a little bit about your search strategy there.
Yeah, for us, it is, identifying the problem solvers, identifying those who are leveraging technology to solve a global and mass problem. For us, it's not that the talent is not there or the entrepreneurs aren't there. They're often there. That's one thing that's very innate to the Black communities, that we're always problem solving and we're always being entrepreneurs, sometimes out of necessity. The biggest gap that we see in that, we'll start to solve our own problem, but the gaps in terms of access to capital so that we can grow that business into a large firm that could grow to like these technology firms that employ 8,000 people. So that's the gap that we see.
Makes sense. Director Brown, I'd love to bring you in here. Michael, sorry.
That's right.
From your vantage point, you're the decision maker. You consume the research that Andre and others put out, and you appraise inspiring models like Hadia's shop. Then you've got to sort of figure out if and how to implement any of this in your state. Before the pandemic, Nevada's minority-owned businesses seem to me to have hit their stride, right? Between 2012, 2018, the number of Hispanic-owned firms increased by an astonishing, I think, 40%. The state is incredibly diverse demographically and spatially, but of course it's highly concentrated in terms of its industries. I know that your shop has recently completed an economic inventory per se, and that some of that work involved like potentially surfacing new industries. Can you walk us through that asset inventory process?
Certainly. Well, first, Nevada is also home to Brookings Mountain West, and we're appreciative to have them present in our state, and they're great advisors to us. First thing we have to do is try to rescue the small businesses that are currently stranded. And if I had been more clever, I would have called it Project Dunkirk, because we created a program of $100 million that Governor Sisolak and our legislature authorized to help small businesses in the state. And we prioritize DBE businesses. And we have taken the applications, and we're in the process of rolling out like $100 million, $48 million of that to DBE businesses. We partnered with the Urban Chamber and the Latin Chamber and the other diversity chambers to make sure that the coaching and the navigation was there to help those small businesses. In our research, one of the things that we discovered was that so many small businesses in Nevada, it was multiple small businesses, multiple gigs that have been put together. And we recognized that first we have to try to save those with these little small ships were sent to rescue the soldiers, these $10,000 grants that we're giving. We're trying to rescue as many of those businesses as possible. We included faith communities. We included nonprofits that are operating in those communities, because we need to make it a holistic approach to help all those businesses. And so that relief effort's underway. Now, as we look forward, in doing this, the state treasurer and I, who partnered on this for compliance reasons, we decided to look at every single application. And if we found a business that we didn't understand, we phoned them. And he and I have talked to probably 2,000 small businesses in the last couple of weeks and really came to understand the challenges that they have as small business. And I think the first realization is running a small business takes a lot of time. And so we've prioritized in our legislature having the lieutenant governor take a stronger leadership role in this area. And then finally, what I'm looking at is economic development tends to be tilted towards the privileged class, you know, high tech, sophisticated companies coming into a state, seeking abatements and incentives. And Ken Evans, who leads our urban chamber, he challenged me the other day, you know, what can we do, you know, to connect our small businesses to these big tech companies that are coming? Well, while I have leverage through the abatement and incentive process, I'm going to be sitting down with those businesses and saying, okay, you know, we welcome you to Nevada, but we want to see a supply chain that taps into our small businesses. We want to see formal hiring. I have a wonderful woman on my staff that's going to lead this effort because we do have the leverage at that moment to, as we embrace them into Nevada, to link them to the communities, the minority communities that need that extra help and need that leg up. And that's an initiative I'll get underway shortly.
Oh, excellent.
Can I just add to that? And first of all, Michael, you have a word processor in your background. That is amazing.
Oh, even better. That is an IBM Selectric typewriter. 3,000 mechanical
typewriter. Wow. I digress, but I just want to pick up government agencies have a large role in this. Because oftentimes they set the bar, particularly around their procurement rules and regulations. So this is the time we really do need government and private industry to set better levels for their supplier diversity requirements, because that can be certainly an incentive and a lever that will lead to the investment in Black-owned firms so that they can then participate in these, to become suppliers.
And I'll tell you, you know, coming from the private sector, I was shocked at how siloed government was when I got inside. And even within my own unit, I had this PTAC unit that was working on procurement, linking small businesses to defense contracts. And I said to him last week, why can't your professionals work with the tech companies and others who are relocating here and do the same thing for them and to navigate that process? And that's what I want to get underway.
Yeah, and those, that's the kind of activity we really do need other government agencies to participate in. And Hadia also mentioned that many of these Black businesses are in majority Black cities. Mm-hmm. And so that's just another area. Again, how can we leverage rules and regulations that for municipalities and states and the federal government to encourage more investment into Black-owned firms, to encourage the scaling up of sorts. So, I just wanted to make sure we said that, because if we clearly need a new regulatory environment, it can't just be about investment, private investment and other forms of investment. There, we also need for governments to encourage this type of activity.
I think that's an excellent point. And I know Michael has thought more about this default posture of government agencies as though they are so risk averse. And they almost sort of seem like private capitalists or private venture capital firms that are trying to ensure that they don't lose their money and not balancing the need of the people, which is more of a social mission. So how do we sort of figure broadening that idea of risk so that we can free up the kinds of capital that we need to see flowing into minority communities? Sean, I want to bring you in here. We've talked about people and jobs, and a lot of what we're seeing in the census is that people are on the move, companies are on the move, and some of that movement and migration is coming into Nevada. But how are we need to sort of figure out how to center people in this conversation, right? After all, we care about the job creation potential of new firms or new businesses or new industries, and that means workers. But we risk rebuilding the status quo, whether it's in Nevada or in a startup scene in Chicago or Baltimore. Underrepresented workers lose out to the privileged class, to borrow Michael's term, especially minority youth. So, you know, tell us how LA Tech, like, how do you sort of tackle this challenge, especially in the midst of, endemic sort of critical learning losses. Community college enrollment is down 10.1%. Yeah. Overwhelmingly Black and Brown students will be part of that sort of fallout. We don't have any data yet on high school dropout rates, but my guess is the data will be just as bad. So we need a theory of change. Tell us about LA Tech's theory of change, and how do you guys move non-traditional youth into tech pipelines? You've had a long history of doing that work.
Thank you, Makeda. Yeah, like I said, I'm executive director of LATech.org, and basically what LATech.org is we're a relatively new organization founded by CEOs of some of the big tech companies here in Los Angeles. The idea of how do we invest in economic opportunity in LA's disconnected communities. Before that, I was executive director of an organization that acted as sort of a workforce intermediary. And I think, you know, the thing that we asked ourselves that was a little bit different that sort of led to our programs is a lot of times when people are looking at, underrepresented groups or these disconnected communities, and they ask themselves, you know, what skills do people need to get access to jobs in these growing industries like tech or others? And instead we asked ourselves, which I think naturally lead you to the supply side of the labor markets, right? You start focusing on community colleges or your training institutions or things like that. And what we did is we took a step back and asked a little bit of a different question, which was basically, well, how do you actually get a job, right? So it's inclusive of those things, of the supply side, but really where it ended up making us focus was a little bit more on the demand side of the labor market. And I think very similar to what Hadia was saying is then you run into some of these very systemic barriers to access, particularly for people. And we are very intentional about using the word from disconnected communities, right? Disconnected from opportunity, right? Because we know that talent is equally distributed, but the opportunities absolutely are not. So when we looked at some of those systemic barriers to access on the demand side, so what were the companies doing that were keeping young people from these communities to getting access? Because we know the talent is there, right? It's like hidden in plain sight. And we found for one, there's a great amount of bias against talent sources or where a lot of these young people come from, largely Black and Brown communities, but as you mentioned, community colleges, right? In Los Angeles County, we have 400,000 community college students right now today, and almost none of them have access to these growing jobs in the tech community, right? And number two, we found there's this, you know, a lot of tech companies use this excuse of pipeline. There's no pipeline, right? And again, part of that is because of their bias against certain talent pools. But another is, we call it the front door, back door problem, in that with a lot of companies, if you want to apply for a job there, you're required to go to submit your application online, and algorithm decides if you're going to see a person or not. And so for a lot of people, that essentially like locks them out. Whereas at the same time, we know that for a lot of our companies, up to 60 to 70% of the jobs can be filled by people who have a personal connection, right? They call it an internal referral in a lot of these companies. And those folks typically look like the people who are already at the companies, right? So it just perpetuates what they already have. And then when you ask, okay, well, what happens? Like, what is the third big barrier is, essentially, if you think about how you get a job, right, it's the alumni associations and the great career services offices and your social networks and all of these other things, all of this invisible infrastructure that sort of privileges the people who are already in these companies is non-existent for the students that we work with, right? So whether they're at community colleges or other things, they just don't have access to those. So the third thing that was the third big barrier that we found. So what our organization does is we partner with the workforce intermediaries, the training providers, so the community college system here in Los Angeles, the workforce system, the government workforce system here in Los Angeles, community-based organizations that work with systems involved young people. Those are the folks we partner with. They are the talent scouts in our mind. And then what we do is we bring the tech community in and we try to break down those barriers around perception by having employees of a lot of our companies do work with those young people from those communities by helping those young people develop their networks and building, I think, Makeda, in a conversation we had, you coined the term the synthetic social networks that match the networks that a lot of the people in the industry already have, giving them access to work-based learning, giving them access to internships, giving them access to essentially information that they need to, and the sort of experience-based learning that they need to get access to the industry.
Yeah, I love LA Tech's story. Thanks, Sean. Hadia, I want to sort of ask you about the startups or young firms that you work with. Like, you're pretty much at the cusp of the kinds of employer firms we hope that will eventually scale into employer firms and have Sean's, his clients, his, and other underrepresented people become part of their workforce. Are your more promising or probably more mature firms thinking of what they might look like as employer firms? Are they engaging with these kinds of conversations around equity? How might we source and value talent differently such that we can be more inclusive in who we're able to hire, who we're able to see in our pipelines?
Thank you. We do a lot of work with employers, specifically VC firms and employers, and some startups who are looking to build pipelines or create opportunities for people who are complementary to their firms. Some of the, going back, I second everything that Sean said, but, one of the things that stands out to us is right now the tech and innovation ecosystem is reaped in a certain privilege, as Sean mentioned, that these communities that are not connected have access to. And so when we talk to, even if we're successful in creating a large pipeline of talent, you get there and the first questions is a feedback that we get a lot of times is, well, when we asked why they wanted to work here, we didn't get a sense that they really knew. And for us, I think about my own cultural background and upbringing and being a new college grad. And if I sat across an employer who said, why do you want to work here? Right. And for my, I think there are certain cultures that do not align passion and purpose with employment. Right. And so I think that that's a huge blinder. And so when I had to go and sit in front of an employer and ask, why do I want to work here? My initial thought was like, you guys are paying, right? Like, I'm here because I need the job. I need the money. But instead having to kind of like anchor in some type of, system of like, oh, your mission is really interesting. When I was never, from my cultural background, I was never taught to align career objectives with like personal passion. And I think that is a somewhat of a privilege that a lot of the communities in tech and innovation have, and they anchor in that. And it's not inclusive to other cultures who do not think about their career and their professional alignment in that way.
Hmm. Okay. Michael.
Yeah.
I know that in your go-ed work recently, you guys are thinking about, hey, how do we sort of capture all of these opportunities that are shifting out of California? And whether it is through, your ideas around taking tax incentives and really saying to companies, if you want to get this, it's not another Amazon HQ2 deal. You're going to have to work for this. Create some supply chain feedback. And in there, you're going to support not to only existing small businesses, but also sort of this sort of new creation. But you are going to have to contend with this sort of competition between to attract these industries, you've got to have a competitive workforce. How do you think about balancing the future workforce needs of Nevadans against this risk or liability of having to import a workforce to stand up these kinds of new companies that are important to your tax base?
I don't want to import a workforce. We've got a talented workforce here. I want to find opportunities for them. 60% of Nevadans, the occupations in Nevada need more than a high school degree and less than a four-year degree. We are a state where community colleges can play an absolute vital role. Brookings Mountain West has made recommendations in this area. The governor has signaled the legislature that he's willing to go as boldly as separating out the community colleges into a separate system if need be. This is an area where we will be spending policy space in it. I am pleased to be doing that. I'm a 30-year Washingtonian and proud to say a graduate of Lorain County Community College. I worked for three Treasury secretaries and before I came west, and I'm pleased to be a graduate of a community college and understand the vital role they play both as an emergency responder and for first generation Americans and for our minority communities as they attempt to move forward. So we will be doing a lot of activity in that space. We don't want to import a workforce. We have a talented workforce. I have a concern that we may see a structural realignment in our gaming sector, and I need to make sure that we have opportunities for those folks. So we're with the reshoring plans of American manufacturers. And I will say that since inaugural day, I have received multiple inquiries from Fortune 500 companies looking to relocate into the Pacific time zone, looking to sort out their logistics. We're well positioned for that. And they want to talk about workforce, and they want to talk about the talent that's here. I also have the advantage that 17% of Nevadans were born elsewhere. And so they have come here to make a new life. They're driven to make a new life here. And so I want to create the opportunities for them.
Andre, let me get you to chime in here. So Michael, I think a lot of states would die to be in your position right now, having Fortune, you know, 100 or 500 companies calling them to think about relocating. But a lot of times, you know, we in the Black community, we're up against a numbers game. We're small, 13% of the population, 124,000 employer businesses. And so it's hard to convince policymakers, even the private business community, that there's productive capacity in Black communities. How should we sort of think about changing this conversation, Andre?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things here. One, that we did a study not that long ago where we looked at the quality of businesses in Black communities. We scraped all the Yelp data, and we controlled for a lot of the neighborhood conditions because we wanted to get an apples to apples comparison of businesses across the United States. And what we found is that after scraping the Yelp data, we found that Asian, Black and Brown owned businesses actually score higher on Yelp than their white counterparts. After you control for sector, it's even. The reason why I say that is that Black, Brown, and Asian businesses don't want for quality. So we have quality services. Now, Yelp is very good when it comes to restaurant and service industries, not so good when it comes to other sectors, but we can use it as sort of a proxy for understanding this, what our elders used to say. They used to always say, our ice is just as cold. And so in many communities, we're essentially losing out on talent because we're not patronizing those businesses. Now, I just want to put out a few stats here. If Black businesses were, Black sort of employer businesses were the equivalent of the Black population, there would be 800,000 more businesses in the economy overall. If Black businesses increased their average revenue to the level of non-Black businesses, we would add close to $700 billion. If the average employees per Black firm increased to 23, which is the non-Black average, we would add 1.6 million jobs. That we would add to the entire economy if we only recognized the talent in our communities and invested in them. So we are a small percentage overall, but if you're talking about New Orleans, we're 60-something percent of the city. When you're talking about Atlanta, we're 50-something percent of the city. When you're talking about Detroit, we're 70% of the city. And that lack of investment is actually throttling those entire regional economies. And then this point I got to make, because we have to remove this assumption that there's this idea that workers have to come in fully trained in order to produce once they get the job. That is a recent phenomenon. Before, businesses took pride in the training of their employees. And I remember, and this is I'm going to be dated. I learned how to program on an Atari 800 XL, where you didn't get that learning in school. You didn't get that learning. McKay is looking at me like, what's an Atari? You like that Atari, what? You know, Atari 800XL. And so many of my peers essentially got jobs. They went on to do great things without these expensive four-year degrees. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, remember, there was a time when the tech sector took pride in saying, you don't have to go to Stanford. You don't have to go to MIT to give you what I need. We'll give you the opportunity. And that's what we need to do today. We have talent. We don't have investment, but we still need to figure out ways to for mainstream institutions to train the talent that's in their midst.
That's a fantastic point. I could not have made it better myself. Sean, you at LA Tech, you guys do this work. I mean, you bump up against the stereotypes all the time. We talked a lot about community colleges here, but to Andre's point, it is we're chasing after the 23 or 24% of people who have a bachelor's degree. In fact, a lot of them are laden with debt, and some for a fair number of them, the degree ain't working in the first place. So how do we convince extant companies and whether it's a scaling company or not, to think about valuing and training workers. And this is not a conversation about only people of color, but there are millions of qualified people, but for the last mile of training, can't show up in a pipeline. What kind of work does LA Tech do to fill those gaps? You know, help us kind of figure out what new models should we be looking to help change this tired old conversation around.
That is really a great point. I mean, I can tell you the one thing I've heard from recruiting departments, HR departments, and companies after we've developed programs with them, the one thing that is almost universal is they'll say, wow, these students have really exceeded my expectations, right? Almost to a T. And like I said, our students, they come from community colleges. They are largely Black and Brown. They're almost all from a low-income background. Many of them have been systems involved where they've been in foster care or have had dealt with issues around homelessness or food insecurity. But when given an opportunity and when given access to ways to get access to these jobs, they usually always step up to the plate and are just as good and in some cases better than where these companies are traditionally recruiting from. So, I agree with Andre. I mean, it's like it's almost like people have blinders on, right? There's all this amazing talent in the community. We refer to it sometimes as hidden talent, but it's, like I said, it's hidden right there in front of them, right? It's like hidden in plain sight. I think a lot of what we do is, and we're very numbers driven, is the first thing that we look at is in terms of why we do the work we do, is we did a study with to look at like what difference does it make to get young people from where they are from these disconnected communities into a job in tech, like what's the differential, and we found that if they get the median job in LA County versus getting them into tech, it's a $2 million differential in lifetime earnings for them, right? So that's $2 million invested in them and their families in their communities over their lifetime for each person, single person, that you divert from a non-tech pathway into a tech pathway in Los Angeles County, right? And as a by the way, to Andre's previous point, we're comparing apples to apples. That's people of color in the tech industry. If you compare them to white men in the tech industry, it's a $2.4 million differential, right? So if we equalize them with white men in the tech industry, it would be about $2.4 million. So like starting from that point, we look at this as saying, this is probably, this investment in these young people is probably the biggest, we get some of the biggest return on our investment that you could possibly imagine, right? The relative investments that you're making in them are small compared to the return that you get in terms of investment in them and their communities over their lifetimes. So, and we've also found, in my current organization and the previous one I worked with is in 2019, which is the last year we didn't have COVID, right? We had about 250 young people that ended up in paid internships at tech companies in LA that year. 40% of them converted to work afterwards. So to paid work afterwards, part-time or full-time paid work. And the difference, by the way, did not, it made no difference if they were, had been systems involved before. It made no difference, you know, what their background was. It's an amazing conversion rate, and just shows that, you know, that these communities are often overlooked or ignored, are incredible reservoirs of talent here in LA. And our companies have shown that. I think the investment, though, that you need to think about is, everybody only thinks about jobs, or they only think about internships. When I think you need to expand, you know, where do people pick up this experience that then allows them to get access to that job? And I think the thing that people don't focus on, that people who are in these companies already get, is essentially access to the industry before they have to have a job, before they have to go to their interview. So, you know, in the industry parlance, they call that work-based learning. But if you think about it, it's activities that introduce young people to careers in technology. It's activities that allow those young people to explore careers in technology, that allows them to do job preparedness training. You know, as some young people we work with often have never done a job interview before, right? They don't know that companies are interviewing for a cultural fit, or, as Hadia said, you know, that they're, you know, that you have to show your passion for their business. They don't know any of that until they get access to the industry to be able to develop that. So in terms of the numbers we've looked at, again, in 2019, we had about 5,000 students that had access to those touch points with industry. So they did some activity with one of our companies. Our goals over the next 2 years are to try to bring 1,000 young people of color from disconnected communities into tech companies as interns, as paid interns, and then have about 20,000 young people in Los Angeles take part in some activity with one of our tech companies. So career awareness, exploration, job readiness, everything from, you know, mentorship to mock interviews. So just all along those lines. And I think, you know, the way you have to hold industry's feet to the fire, because when they complain about the pipeline issue, you can say, well, are you investing in internships? Are you investing in using your volunteer hours and your corporate social responsibility to send your employees into these communities to introduce these young people to these careers, allowing them to explore the careers? Are you providing mentorship opportunities? Are you just doing hackathons at Beverly Hills High School? Or are you also doing it at Crenshaw High School, right? I mean, those are the questions that we need to hold our company's feet to the fire on.
Yeah, not to say one quick point to that. I completely agree with everything Sean said. In addition, we need to give employers exposure to students. That's what's also missing, that many employers have never touched, talked to, been or worked with people of color. And so what they're really fearing is they fear the cultural differences, not the talent. If you work in any kind of immigrant space or any space where you really see or talk with and work with people who are not from the country you are, you quickly understand that intelligence doesn't have an accent, right? You quickly learn that your tattoos, your hair, that it doesn't matter. But when it comes to workers in particular industries, it's almost as if let's lean on the finishing schools of college to vet these people instead of engaging in a way that you can really see if some person has talent. And I know there's employers out there, if they would just train themselves not to see talent in such a limited way, they would quickly see that there's all these, the pipeline equivalent is full. Waiting.
To that point, Andre, I want to get Michael to respond to. That's exactly the question. We've been talking about workers and new jobs, and there's been this implicit assumption that we're talking about prime age, people of prime working age, and also younger workers. But in Nevada's case, you've got an entire industry that, you know, where hospitality workers, a fair share of them are older workers, they're overexposed to hospitality work. Michael, how are you thinking about places and spaces and new opportunities for older workers?
Well, before I touch that, let me get back to this is a point of great leverage. This area of economic development, private activity bonds, all of the tax abatements and incentives, it tends to function in this little twilight zone between the private sector and the public sector. And it's very 19th hole of a golf course. So I didn't come out of that world and I didn't believe in it. And my governor is a former county commissioner. And so we started immediately pressing folks about hiring and about community commitment and about salaries and about veteran hiring. And we started doing it on housing projects and then it extended into this area. Government has incredible leverage to produce change here. And the power in these kinds of economic development opportunities rests on our side. You know, these companies are seeking perhaps abatements and incentives of a state's revenue source. They need to go the extra mile. And so I think that I would challenge people to challenge their economic development authorities. Many of the folks that I've talked to, they view community redevelopment and community support as kind of outside their purview, that they should just be trying to bring new businesses to Nevada or to their state, and then hopefully everything sorts itself out. That's not enough. You know, our next round of applications will include questions where we want them to detail their corporate social responsibility programs, their hiring programs, their diversity measures, because I think the power rests on our side if we're willing to exert it and come out of that little 19th hole of a golf course culture in this area. As for senior workers, you know, we have a large senior population here, and research from your institution, from Brookings, also shows we have one of the widest cultural gaps in America, with folks over 65 largely being a large white population, and folks under 18 being largely communities of color. And so, you know, this is a constant challenge. Now, the nature of a lot of Nevada's gig working is it does provide opportunities for seniors, particularly those that might be semi-retired, to find work. But obviously, the first thing we have to do is get folks back to work after the pandemic's over. I think going forward, we're going to look at our economy and everything is going to be framed as pre and post pandemic. And I think looking into the rearview mirror is not going to get you where you need to be. And I'm hoping that 21 is that pivot year. But the lessons that I've taken away and Zach Conine, our state treasurer, and Governor Sisolak, you know, we've really come to understand the fragile nature of our minority communities. And we're going to do everything we can to fix it, help it.
I appreciate that. I want to pivot now and give our audience a chance to chime in here. Hadia, Nigel is asking, how would the inclusion of a national skills training program into the Biden Racial Equity Initiative help solve proprietorships and grow Black businesses? What I would sort of reframe and ask you, would a national skills training program be helpful to the businesses that you work with in your VCU collaborative and your ecosystem? Andre, there's a question for you about your book, right? So East Liberty in Pittsburgh, you featured that case study on that city. What lessons can be drawn from the reinvention of East Liberty and how might they be applied to other regional economic efforts, particularly those that rely on competing for what is considered a rare and highly skilled portion of a population? And then, Michael, I'll pivot to you on what are municipalities doing to support the rise of independent workers and empowering those without network or net worth capital? And Sean, this is going to be a rapid round here. I want you to sort of speak to this question we received that I thought was really interesting. How can cities and states provide training and jobs for undocumented workers in the absence of immigration reform?
Did I kick off?
Yeah, sure.
My question had to do around, I guess, the benefit, or will a national skills program or retraining effort work? And I need to really respond with a resounding no. Oh. And I want to anchor, go back to what Andre said in terms of anchoring on the industry and the employers who are making the decisions right now. And I don't want us to skirt around the racism, the systemic racism that exists, and Andre mentioned this when he talked about getting the employers to see that there is a limitation that changed their mindset in terms of how they see this talent coming in. I think the industry really has to hold on to this feeling that right now there is a moral imperative and both an economic imperative, and truly understand that, you know, go beyond the talk and take serious action. This is not a problem that was created by the Black, Indigenous, or Latinx communities. Obviously, we're here because it impacts us, but this solution does not fall on our shoulders to solve. And so I turn that back directly to the industries and the employers to make this change and to really take systemic action towards removing the barriers.
Anyone else can feel free to jump in.
I was asked a question about my hometown, Pittsburgh, and a community that I went to school in and lived nearby in East Liberty. When I was growing up, Google was not in Pittsburgh. It was a Nabisco cookie factory. And up the street closer to my home, it was actually Westinghouse, the engineering firm. And so I want to remind people that Black communities have always lived next to tech firms and high growth sectors in a lot of places. And just to remind people that proximity does not necessarily lead to improvement. And we've seen this time and time again, cities giving away the farm to recruit a big tech company with hopes that the current workers will see quality of life improvements. The reality is in Pittsburgh and in other cities, service work, working class work actually saw a decrease in wages as a result. And so if we were to do it all again, I would say invest in those budding companies in your town instead of giving all kinds of tax incentives to companies to come in. I certainly think there are times we should import talent. I'm an academic. We do it all the time in colleges and think tanks. We import talent. But when it comes to industry and communities, you almost have to have a certain percentage of your community working in those industries for it to really benefit the overall community. And so I would say, don't give away the farm. I would say use those incentives and resources to invest in companies that are homegrown. And this is another thing be clear. This goes back to piling on. We've got to remove the drags of racism that prevent people from getting the opportunity. Again, looking at the builder's profile that the Gallup company produces, they found that Black, Brown, Asian, and White communities do not differ at all when it comes to the profiles of entrepreneurs in your community. Meaning that there's, if all things were equal, you would probably see the same amount of entrepreneurs from a Black community as a White community, which tells you there's something else blocking that path. And so instead of assuming that we have a pipeline problem, we should not. And we should continue to press to remove the drags of racism that prevent that talent from becoming business owners.
Hey, Sean.
I think, who was next, Sean or, yeah.
Sean or Michael, it's.
Oh, I'll go. I grew up in the Cleveland area. And, everything you try to do in the Cleveland area involves, 45 other municipalities. I'm fortunate now in Las Vegas that you basically can get four people in a room and you have the metropolitan area. And so some of the workforce, particularly programs, are much better executed at the local level. The state government has struggles to get out of its way in this space, where the local governments can operate much more flexibly in that space. And I think Bruce Katz Brookings has outlined, you know, the advantages that exist in that area, and we need to be there to support them. We also, we use some CARES Act dollars to deploy something called Skills Match, which is a program that allows folks to put all of their skills in and align it up with job opportunities, you know, and we also took some of the CARES Act dollars and put it into our community colleges for workforce training in that area. You know, while these federal resources are there, we need to make use of them. We are prioritizing building an office in the state treasurer's office to win more federal grants and bring them to Nevada. We've always been a bit adverse to that, and we need to change that philosophy because the money's going to get spent. We need to make sure Nevada gets its fair share. And I agree, you know, on abatements and incentives, the power is on the state side. Use it while you have the leverage.
Thank you.
And I just can't agree more with Andre and Hadia, just in terms of the issues around, I don't feel like we need new training programs or a national training program. I feel like if we start to break down the barriers, these sort of systemic barriers, that are there, that those will, the training institutions will start to change in response to that. And right now, you know, a lot of this, you know, I think as Andre was saying, exposure to new talent sources, exposure to people from these communities, I think are the things that will help, you know, move us towards to a new place. Because I think like with us, a lot of our work is it's basically how do we create community organizers inside tech companies, right? So how do we convert employees there into advocates for these communities? Because that's the only way that things are going to change. So a lot of what we focused on in the past to that point is getting employees from our tech companies into the communities, working with our young people. And then they're the ones that usually go back to their companies and then go to their HR department or the recruiting department and say, I want my next intern to come from, you know, LA City College or from, you know, some of the other schools that we work with. So that's number one. To the question you asked around undocumented workers or undocumented students, it's a difficult question. I mean, here in California, you know, most of our educational institutions, public educational institutions, whether it's community colleges or state universities, have a lot of undocumented students that are there. We, you know, with our programs, we try to make sure that that they still get the same access to industry as everybody else does. You know, we, until the point that at which they are applying for a job, in which case, you know, that issue, it becomes an issue. So for all of our work-based programs, we even have, for example, an academy we do with Snapchat, and we've structured it as a scholarship as opposed to a job, because we've had a few undocumented students who've been part of that program, just to make sure that they have that opportunity. We've had a number of students that are part of the DACA program who've come through and gotten access to work in some of our companies. Honestly, though, if you're talking about employment, you know, that it becomes really difficult. I feel like, you know, at that point, entrepreneurism is probably a path that I think I've seen a lot of young people in California take when those other opportunities aren't available to them. Mm.
Thank you, Sean. Very sobering note to end on. I will say that I want to echo your point, Hadia's point, Andre, and certainly Michael's here. We've got a moral and economic imperative to reinvent our communities. But as Michael said, looking into the rearview mirror will mostly result, in my view, in rebuilding, you know, the structural inequities and disadvantages or structural advantages for the privileged class. So we've got an enormous opportunity in front of us. It's either we do it now or it never gets done. Entrepreneurs, the kinds of business losses, whether it's large corporate firms or small businesses that we've lost, we need to replace those businesses with new opportunities and out competing between states and communities to get the remaining sort of firms. That's not going to work.
We have to be inclusive about the about our way forward, and we can't tiptoe around structural racism, and building a national skills program is not going to solve it either. I feel like we're out of time. It looks like we are out of time. I want to say a hearty thank you to the panelists. Thank you, Andre, Hadia, Sean, and Michael for joining. And thanks to our viewers for tuning in. I think we didn't get to a lot of the questions, but I hope that you guys continue to engage with us. Please continue to tweet us your thoughts, your comments, and your questions to @BrookingsGov. Once again, thanks so much. It has been a fantastic discussion.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Carnival.